Before we get to today's podcast, I want to remind you about another great ESPN podcast, the Woj Pod. Every week, Woj chats with the newsmakers in and around the NBA, players, coaches, executives, and more. This week, he's been all over the trade deadline, so be sure to check that out. Download the Woj Pod and the right time wherever you get your podcasts. Let's talk about Daniel. A year ago, he resolved to stop putting off what he wanted to do, get into information technology. Daniel enrolled in My Computer Career and is already a few months into his IT career. Make 2020 your year. There are millions of unfilled cybersecurity positions in the U.S. right now, and My Computer Career is training people to help fill them. No IT experience or education? No problem. It's not rocket science. It's My Computer Career. Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take the free career evaluation today. You can start your new life as an IT pro in months, not years. Attend classes on campus or live online just twice a week to get what you'll need to start your new career. More than just a school, My Computer Career helps you get into the industry by working with hundreds of employers that hire our students. My Computer Career is nationally accredited and financial aid is available for those who qualify, including the GI Bill. Classes start soon, so make new year, new career your resolution and take the free career evaluation today at mycomputercareer.edu. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's the time of week where we bring on a guest. And joining us now, you check him out at ESPN. Be sure to check out his new book, Full Dissidence. His name is Howard Bryant. Howard, I guess we start with how you decided to go with that title on the book.
Well, the title really started from being on the air, I think, 2016, during the controversy with Colin Kaepernick, and it was revealed that he didn't vote. And everybody was pearl-clutching and losing their minds about how this completely undermined everything that Colin Kaepernick had ever said or stood for. How dare he not vote? And I said, well, maybe Colin Kaepernick has gone full dissident. And maybe he's realizing that your entire system is a mess, and why would he contribute to the system? If voting is part of the system, why would he contribute to it if it were part of the problem? So that's where the phrase first came from. And as time started to go on, I started to realize and started to think about how I felt about so many of these different areas that I was writing about, and realized that the title was appropriate. And so I went with it.
2016, man, like, is this for people our age going to be the 1968, just like such a focal point? And it, like, and I guess in 1968 was kind of a culmination of stuff. 2016 kind of feels like the beginning.
And even then, exactly. It's going to be interesting when the historians do their history thing. Is it September 11, 2001? You know, is it November 2008? Is it November 2016? When you start thinking about that demarcating line, that intersection. For me, for this book, I was already under contract writing this stuff, and 2016 just solidified it. I was already working on the book, but after that election, it hit me. There were a bunch of things hit me dead in the face. Number one, the first thing was, I think that I was like, a lot of relationships are going to change. A lot of relationships are going to end. And I think that, to me, when you think about what was going on for Black people over the previous years, number one, you think about the 2008 election and you're talking about this whole idea of post-racialism, and then you elect Donald Trump and that sort of threw cold water all over that idea. Even if you were a non-believer in the idea of post-racialism during the Obama administration, this was a punch right dead in the face, right? And there was that. And I started thinking about it for me. We all grew up, you know, you and I, Bill, we've been talking about this stuff for years as well. But when you grow up in an integrated environment, or when you grow up not really integrated, but in that white suburban rural type environment where you're the only Black kid in class all the time and you're the one who's constantly in that level of isolation, it made me think. It made me think a lot about those relationships. And all of these different things where everybody says they're rational and everybody thinks we all have the same values and we all grew up around the same type of thing. And then you start talking about the real issues. You start talking about policing. You start talking about militarization. You start talking about Kaepernick, and you start talking about all of these different ideas. And then you realize that you and your white friends, for example, may not have anything in common. In fact, all these people that you've been sitting around the whole time, you're on the exact opposite political spectrum sometimes. That needed a lot of discussion.
And in sports, it became interesting because with Kaepernick in 2016, all of a sudden, and I was talking about this the other day on the show, that the Super Bowl this year really pointed out and reminded you that nobody really cares what you do during the national anthem. We saw the president not really do, you know, not really paying attention during the national anthem. We saw Jay-Z, who says he is, we are beyond kneeling. He couldn't even bother to stand
up.
Right? Mm-hmm. Nobody cared. Beyonce, who is a crazy flashpoint on so many things, she sat there next to him. Nobody really cared. But Kaepernick said, I didn't stand for the anthem, the oppression of black and brown people. And that is the problem, right? Like, that was the crystallization of what the issue was right then and there.
Right then and there, and it struck me as I started to think about this as well, that there's an aggressive anti-blackness taking place in sports, and people don't want to hear it, and that adds to the anti-blackness taking place in sports. And when we were on this program talking about my last book, talking about the heritage, part of that book was really all about this conversation about the return to power of these black athletes. And we talk about these black athletes being the most visible, the most influential, the best compensated black employees this country's ever produced. And then I started to have sort of a recorrection on that. I started thinking about something else. How much power do you really have if you are afraid to use it, if you risk losing everything by opening your mouth, if you advocate for a black position, that it all goes away, it can all be taken away? How much power do you really have? Maybe you don't have nearly as much power as you think you have, but what you do have is a lot of money, and they're not the same thing.
Yeah, that's been the interesting learning part. In fact, that was another thing I think that touched on the Jay-Z situation in particular, where I think that people learn Jay-Z has $1 billion, but how much power does Jay-Z have?
100%. Not just how much power does he have, but what is his value system and perspective in terms of contributing in a positive way to this? I think that the idea is because he's involved, there's influence. And because he's there, he's representing a position that we can all agree with. And I think that we need to stop talking in pronouns and get right down to the absolute directness of what are we really, really talking about. And you start to find that a lot of this just starts to crumble.
Did you see the quotes that he had, by the way, why it was that he did not stand for the anthem?
It was word salad. It was Michelin star word salad. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. I'm like, okay, if you were working, if you were busy, or if you were stand up then or not. But if you're not, then say you're down with this. And all of it felt very performative to me. And it all felt, once again, one of the essays in the book is all about the hero game and about this over-reliance of celebrity on celebrity. And why are we following these people? And why do we necessarily need them, especially in terms of black celebrity? Why do black people cape so hard for celebrity? And the reason, at least my feeling, and the reason is I'm always interested in your feelings on it. The reason for me is because black celebrity, that black entertainment celebrity, is all we have in a lot of ways. These are the people who made it for us. These are the ones who represent us. They're the richest amongst us. They're the ones that so often we've been told that we need to aspire to. But at the same time, by following and protecting them, are we necessarily making the right choice when actually maybe we should be critiquing them a little bit more?
Yeah, because I think part of it, too, with celebrity is that celebrities tend to have money. And the closest thing that we've figured out in general is at the least we can try to do is get some of this money, right? Like, I think that there's an understanding that comes a lot of times when people get to these places that they have won the one thing that maybe you got a chance of winning in this game, which is the chance to get a bunch of money. I think the other part of it, too, becomes that there are a lot of people who feel as though aspirational figures for them are hard to come by. And so the ones on television are the ones that they point to. Like, that's the best that I've got on that. But you're right.
Well,
like,
that's right.
Like, so much of this is Jay-Z is a famous person. It doesn't even matter like what the reason is that he is famous, but Jay-Z is a famous person now. Where Jay-Z, the famous person, lost me was. So, like, my dad always talks about this, that, like, what we think of in 2020 as being left wing or being center or being right is totally different than it was 40, 50 years ago.
That's right.
Right? Like, it's not, like, what is passing for left now would have been right in the 1960s, right? Like, everything has kind of, like, been recalibrated. And what Jay-Z tried to recalibrate to me was protest, where he said he didn't need to protest the anthem because he said that he was protesting by, you know, running the ads and all that stuff. And I'm like, by definition, it ain't a protest if it's being done hand in hand with the NFL, right?
Exactly. If you're asking for approval, it's not a protest. And I'm listening to this, and I sit there and I go, this is bullshit. This is complete and total bullshit. And across so many lines, this sort of concierge level access to power to replace protest is one of the most damaging and dangerous things that we have allowed and accepted in the culture. And I don't care who you are. I don't care how much money you've got, or where you come from. Just turn on CNN International. And what do you see around the world? You see bodies in the street. You see people. No government in the history of mankind has ever been able to deal with or repel enough bodies in the streets. And yet in the United States, we seem to think, whether it's the Players Coalition or whether it's Jay-Z or Roc Nation or whomever, that, oh, I can make a call to Roger Goodell, or I can call my local congressman, or I can go do some ride along with the cops, and that's going to replace bodies in the street. And that is a gigantic hoax. That is the, that you look at that and you say, it's completely ahistorical. It may go hand in hand, having to have people in the legislature. Obviously, you look at someone like John Lewis, or you look at Marion Barry, or you look at Andrew Young. They were all on the front lines, and then they moved into government over time. But they were first with Martin Luther King Jr. on the front line. So when you hear these guys say, oh, well, man, you can't just take a knee. You got to be about action. That is a slap in the face to every protest ever across the history of the world. It's nonsense.
I saw those quotes, and then also it was the long thing in the New York Times. And again, the guy that can get that kind of favorable coverage in the New York Times is not the dude turning the apple cart over, but is acknowledging the fact that that's not going to be the guy who's going to wind up getting this done. But it's interesting that I bring all this up because with Kaepernick starting this in 2016, this has kind of become the culmination of that for the NFL. And on one hand, I'm surprised they're even running ads for Inspire Change. But then I saw the ads they ran and I was like, oh, gotcha.
Well, and then the ads that they ran completely in line with Donald Trump and his political positions and his reelection. You run a camp, you run something on Alice Johnson, you run something on Botham Jean, you run something about Anquan Boldin's cousin. I understand the reflex. I understand the impulse. I don't like the tactics. And the thing that has bothered me about all of this is that the need that the Players Coalition seems to have for that paternalism. I get it with the players, especially. I don't know what Malcolm Jenkins is going to do when his career is over. More than likely, there's a pipeline for him to be in that Troy Vincent management role if he wants to be there. There's that pathway now. There is not that pathway for Colin Kaepernick or Eric Reid or Kenny Stills or those guys because they've gone against the power. But what I really don't understand, too, is who are we rehabilitating here? When I watch those commercials in the Super Bowl, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, you don't have any buy-in from the police. You don't have any buy-in from the police unions. You don't have any buy-in from any of the power structures out there who we expect to meet at least halfway with the families to say, look, we'll do a better job. We'll try really hard not to kill you when you're in your own house eating ice cream. We're going to do a better job because our job is to protect you. Instead, you've got these black families who have already been to the funerals. They've already buried their own. And they're the ones begging for humanity. Please, please treat us like we belong. Please treat us with some dignity and some humanity. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, this doesn't serve anybody except the people who are already in power. Because the people who are already in power, they've conceded nothing. Nothing at all. What have we seen with the Players Coalition and the police units? What have we seen anything on the police side reaching toward the community? We keep talking about police-community relations. I see community relations. I don't see any police at all.
And Botham Jean, the problem that I had with the use of that example is very simple. this isn't really the situation we're talking about. It was
yeah, even talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah, like
exactly
it was
right.
like it was the situation we were talking about when he just got smoked in his house, right? And it was the situation that we were talking about when it looked like Dallas police was taking every step to protect an officer who we have to remember was not on duty when this happened. But this is mm-hmm. not what we're talking about because the woman, and it's worth noting, the woman ultimately got time, right? The That's issue right. with this and why we react so strongly when people get killed by the police is the tacit understanding that nothing is ultimately going to happen, that nobody is going to be punished. I felt like they actually put an ad up that said, oh no, people be getting punished. Watch, see, do this and you're going to go to jail. Like it's only a matter of time before they get the thing up with that Chinese dude in New York who shot the guy in the project hallway and wound up going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We'll hear about that one too. But like Tamir Rice is not going to wind up on this.
That's right. That's the issue. And that's the hocus pocus. That's sort of the misdirection that you're seeing in these ads. And I think that's the part of this whole thing, book-wise. When I was working on these essays, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, listen, at some point, you have to, as a sports fan, you have to be a lot more circumspect about what you're looking at. And you have to look at what you're looking at with a bit more of a critical eye. That may interfere with fun when you're watching the Super Bowl, but there is a manipulation taking place here. And I do see it as a level of anti-blackness. And you cannot, whether or not you want to or whether you don't, this cannot be separated from Colin Kaepernick. And it's a really interesting part when you're talking about, you know, what is that demarcating line going to be? What is that year moment going to be? It's fascinating to me that we're entering year four of the Colin Kaepernick story. And he's still very central to the culture. And I still just feel that the players, and like I said, I respect the players. I respect what Malcolm Jenkins and the McCourty brothers, I respect what they're doing because they are getting involved. I just don't really agree with their tactics. And I don't understand why they feel the need to rehabilitate the NFL, because the NFL owners, when you follow exactly what they're putting their money toward, in terms of their political positions, they run completely counter to everything that the Players Coalition say they stand for.
All right, we'll be back in a minute with more with Howard Bryant. But first, hiring is challenging. But there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. And growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Cafe Altura COO Dylan Miskovitz experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But then he switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates faster. In fact, after posting his job to ZipRecruiter, Dylan said he was amazed by how quickly candidates were applying and found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder how 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BOMANI. It is very difficult to reconcile all of those ideas. And for the book, the idea really is, like you say, is to really break down and get into these ideas. So for you, which essay do you think that you put in there, the issue that you looked at and was like, yo, we got to do this, really jumped out for you as being one that you're like I am particularly glad we got this one out here?
There's a couple of them. I probably think the worst thing in the world is probably one from a sports standpoint that hit me, because I think about this aggressive sort of anti-blackness and I began to think about this through line that has been going on my entire life. And you think about the way that essay broke down. You start with, I'm not black, I'm OJ in 1969. Then you move forward to, I'm not black, I'm Cablin Asian to Tiger Woods. Then you look at Madison Keys. I'm not black or white, I'm just me. And you start thinking about this through line, this black attitude through line, which is, I can be everything, but don't associate me with that. And that a choice is being made. It's not to say, especially when you're dealing with biracialism, when you deal with people who say, well, why do they have to choose? Or why can't Tiger Woods embrace his Thai-ness or his Caucasian-ness or his his Indianness or whatever, or why can't Madison Keys identify with her white mother? And I'm not saying that you can't. What I'm saying is that a choice is being made, and let's acknowledge the fact that a choice is being made. And let's also acknowledge that because a choice is being made, because these athletes know the price of what's going to happen if you accept blackness as part of your political persona of or of your personality. You know what's going to happen to your endorsement. You know what's going to happen in terms of how the crowd and the fans view you and all of that. So let's put that on the table and recognize that this is something that athletes have been navigating, and it's been happening for half a century.
Yeah, the navigation of that, because it's always tricky, right? Because on one hand, if we were like assume these things in a vacuum, you should be able to say, hey, I am just who I am. Okay, but those aren't the rules, right? Like it's always comical when you have these people, at least for me, who think that by themselves, they're going to overhaul this whole thing.
Exactly.
And be like, you are not going to define me. And that's cute, mm-hmm. right? But they're going to define you.
Absolutely. The culture is going to define you. And especially when you're Tiger Woods and you get a DUI, and what's it say on that police report? It says you're black. Didn't say you were Cablin Asian. It said you were black. So what happens to all those words and all that navigation? And I think for me, the other part of that essay that I appreciated discussing was that this isn't something that happens in the lower class. Usually when you're trying to engage in some form of erasure or when you're doing some sort of experiments on the people, you start with the low, the people who are going to be forgotten. But what's happening here when you're talking about this level of erasure and negotiation, it's happening with the talented tenths, with the cream of the crop. It's talking with the super millionaire black athletes. And the super millionaire black professionals. How many times over the course of my career have I heard black reporters say, or black writers, I don't want to be a black writer. I'm just a writer who happens to be black. And I'm not a black doctor. I'm just a doctor who happens to be black. And I'm like, what are you doing? You know, so what you're really saying is that I don't feel like negotiating this. I don't want this. I don't want to be what I am. And for you, white collar, top of your profession person to feel that way. What are we really saying? What is the message that's being sent? I don't want to be a black writer. I just want to be a writer. I mean, do you ever hear any other race of people talk like this?
Nah.
I don't want to be an Irish writer. I mean, if you're Oscar Wilde or something, I just want to be never. You never hear that. And so this level of erasure is a real thing, and it's a matter of navigation. And I get it. I get it, because once you decide that you're going to take this position, now you got to carry stuff, and it's hard enough living. It's hard enough playing. It's hard enough hitting the ball with a stick. And then you got to carry this, too, in interviews and being part of the news cycle, which affects your trade value and affects, you know, your salaries. I get it. But look at the negotiation that's being made. Look at what's being asked of black people.
Well, it's also interesting, I think, for a lot of those people, because I think they're part of vocally saying that I am not this is in such a way is because we the ones who know we ain't just going to sneak past, right? Because there are other people with reasons to believe that they can navigate this just by nobody really noticing. Nah, they notice. We know.
Well, that's right. And now you look at it, and I said this the other day, and now you're looking at it, and now suddenly mixed-ish is a choice. Now you can choose to opt out of blackness all of a sudden in the special 2020s. Now all of a sudden when Patrick Mahomes wins the Super Bowl, people say, well, you know, his mother's white. I'm like, well, so is Barack Obama's, but y'all made him look like an ape.
Yo, that's an interesting thing, though, because I also think that part of why some people have the perceptions they do about Russell Wilson is they are under the mistaken impression that one of his parents is white. Nah, man,
yep,
he just got
right.
that hair. You see him the other day?
I did. I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, that's a combination between us. That's Ian McShane and Ron O'Neill right there.
Like, what do you call a conk when it's not a conk?
What do you call a conk when it's not? I was like, he ain't even pressing that. He ain't hot combing that.
He's like, CeCe, go give me that. CeCe, go give me some pink lotion.
I saw that. I couldn't breathe. I was like, Russell, man, you super fly right now.
But like, it's funny though, but like the ultimate, you know, the guy, well, I guess I don't know sports, if this counts as a guy in sports, but the guy who lives this is The Rock, because The Rock is black. The Rock tells you he's black. But if you talk to wrestling fans and start talking about like The Rock is black, oh no, all of a sudden he becomes so Samoan.
They'd be like, no.
They're like, no, we like him.
No, I was like, you got him confused with Jimmy Snuka. He's the forward.
But they're like, yo, we like him. And so you see this push to be like, nah, it's not really what it is. Because like Mahomes, this is interesting because so we have now had three black quarterbacks to win a Super Bowl. But even if people can't articulate it, I think they'll all be honest about it. Doug Williams winning it, even not just simply because he was the first, but Doug Williams winning it feel a whole lot different than Russell Wilson or Patrick Mahomes, right? And it would have felt different if it was Lamar Jackson.
That's right. Well, and what is that too? That's that colorizing right there, because and there is this whole idea of authenticity, of authentically black, and you know, and I do think that when you look at somebody like, I mean, Pat Mahomes has not jumped into the fray. He's avoided the whole thing. And so the claiming that is taking place, it will be very interesting to see where that navigation takes him. Because when you see this in the culture now, all of a sudden, now that you can claim and you can opt in and opt out if you're biracial, that's an interesting new pathway. And I'm interested to see what these players are going to do with it. I think we already have an idea of what they're going to do with it. But what's going to happen the minute they struggle? Then they'll go back to being black.
Well, yeah, well, Dak Prescott is in that interesting lane in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Because the people, like, there have been articles about this where they try to make the argument that Dak Prescott being biracial allows him to go on both sides and talk to white people, and he knows how to talk to black people. Now, the way Dak talks about these things, because he's like, yeah, my mom's side, the English teacher, you know, you go over there, teachers and stuff, and then I go over the black side of my family, and they're selling drugs. And it's like, Dak.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? Exactly. You know, can we get a do-over on that one, Dak?
Yeah, but there's...
Well, and that also informs it, too, though.
Yeah. No, I think there's something too that I gotta be curious to know the people specifically, right? Like, rather than in general, but he has been billed as a guy that can do that in the locker room specifically on the basis of being biracial, right? The thought is he knows white people, can talk to them. He knows black people, he can talk to them. And by the way, he was excellent last season, right? There's no way around it. He was excellent. Yeah. Now he's trying to get his money, and I don't know why they're not giving him his money. And I'm not saying that like with a wink. I'm really like, I don't know why they're not giving his money. I just noticed that they're not.
Well, you know what's real interesting about him is that in a lot of ways, he is the millennial version of Troy Aikman, and his numbers, when you look at them, they are the millennial version in some ways. They're much, much, much better than Aikman's, although Aikman didn't play in this era where everybody can throw for 5,000 yards. You know, I mean, the measures are different because of the pass interference and the wide open game and the whole thing. But he is being penalized in some ways in a way that Aikman really never was. You could have penalized Troy Aikman all day if you wanted to, because that was a running team.
Yes.
You could have penalized Troy Aikman all you wanted. Say, well, his numbers really not that good. And when you look at him in terms of, you know, elite quarterbacks, he's really not putting up the numbers, but you didn't. But when it comes to Dak, because they are also a running team, the question is, well, why isn't he better offensively, even though he was terrific offensively? Or can he really carry a team offensively? And, you know, what would he really be, you know, without Zeke? And it's really interesting, all the different sort of negotiations. But one of the things you said earlier that I thought was interesting on this too was the reason why Dak is expected to be able to like navigate and code switch these, you know, both these lanes isn't simply a racial thing. It's also a class thing.
Yes.
It's the fact that, see, the white side of me is legitimate. The black side of me is illegitimate, and I can navigate the illegitimate world and the legitimate world. And it would be very, very different, you know, in terms of his authenticity, if he were in the Jeter class where mom and dad are both professionals. Dad's a doctor. Now what? And you know how brothers are when it comes to stuff like that. They'll look at you like you have to hand your card over if you're a black professional and you don't necessarily navigate. And it's also something that white people have done to us, that the black experience has to be ghetto. And if that black experience isn't ghetto, you ain't really black.
I also feel like this all speaks to a tacit acknowledgement of the segregation of the NFL locker room that people really don't like to talk about, right?
They don't talk about it because they don't know it. You know, when you walk into the NFL, and I covered both the Patriots and the Washington football team, you walk in there, and that might as well have been a CNN red map, blue map. You know, you walk in there and the offensive line is a bunch of white dudes all hanging out together for the most part. You go look at the DBs, they're all hanging out together. You go look at the wide receivers because it's all division of labor anyway, right? And you don't often get, I mean, I think people look at that and they hear all the stupid football cliches about trenches and brotherhood and foxholes and all that and going to war with each other. And the minute practice is over, you look at that and that looks like Sunday morning at 11 o'clock.
Yep. And when you talk to reporters about it, they'll be like, yo, man, you know, these locker rooms are really segregated. Like nobody really, it's like almost a whisper. Nobody notices that if there is a good white quarterback and a not even good white receiver, just a white receiver on a football team, they're always roommates. Right?
Yep.
Like every single time they always wound up being roommates. It's, there's yep. no, like all
Jerry Rice and Steve Young weren't roommates.
Right. Right. All these things happen. And I think that people really have no idea when they tell us the stick of sports are to avoid the race discussion. Like 2020 going to be crazy with some of these teams.
Yeah, it is. And the reason why they don't want to talk about it is because what does it do? It's going to force you to recognize black people. Now you're going to have to talk about this again. And that's one of the essays in The Worst Thing in the World, where the James Baldwin quote is in there saying what progress is really the fastest that, you know, that black people can become white. That's the real idea of progress. That's all progress means. And so that's why the first sentence of the whole book is to be black is to be a dissident. It's because every time we bring this into it, people get uncomfortable. They get mad. They won't allow you to be part of this conversation. They won't, they will not allow, there's no willingness to say, okay, you are a unique part of this conversation, but you still own piece of it. You own pieces of it. You have a piece of it. Instead, it's like, no, we have to find ways to erase you. You're the problem. It goes back to the Du Bois line back in Souls of Black Folk, or was it Black Reconstruction back in 1902? How does it feel to be the problem?
All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk with Howard Bryant. But first, tired of that 230 feeling? You're not alone. In fact, research shows that more than 70% of us hit the wall after lunch. Let a 5-hour energy shot help you leap over that wall instead of crashing into it. Anyone who travels frequently knows how tiring it can be. Whether you're on business or on vacation, 5-hour energy shot can help you stay alert and energized wherever you may be headed. 5-hour energy helps you get through your crazy on-the-go life. With zero sugar, 4 calories, and a convenient portable size, it's the perfect pick-me-up for busy, hard-working people. Now it comes in 2 extra-strength tropical tastes, strawberry banana and tropical burst. They're great. They are delicious and can take you to a tropical on-the-go experience. Try them both, then go online to shop5hourenergy.com and use the code BOMANI to receive a one-time offer of 10% off your order. That's shop5hourenergy.com. Use the code BOMANI. Go to shop5hourenergy.com and use the code BOMANI to receive a one-time offer of 10%. 5-Hour Energy. Energy on the go. Another essay that I thought was interesting in the book, and of course something you and I have talked about a lot, was the one about the military and criticizing the military and really kind of the role that sports is playing now in promotion of the military. And I was thinking about this, right, as I'm the old man on this show, Gabe, born in 1992. It dawned on me, 91,
Gabe.
Sorry, he's 1991. Sorry, let me give him back that extra year.
Oh, that makes him an old head.
Yes, yes, yes. But you got to think about this, man. People his age and younger, like just a couple years younger, do not remember a time where sports did not have all of these military references and displays, right? They came up in 2001.
Yeah, and when it did happen before, it happened very briefly. And when the war was over, they went back to normal. The patches disappeared, the flags disappeared, and then we went back to normal. Once the Gulf War ended, we went back to normal. Post-2001, this is the normal. And also, when you think about it, and people get upset about it, the reason why I think it's important to consider is because this is being done on purpose. Name me places in our culture. All we do in the culture we talk about is how segmented the culture is. You got 300 channels and every person's watching this and this one's streaming that. But there's one place where you get a whole bunch of eyeballs in one place, sports. And so because this is the one place where you get a whole bunch of eyeballs, this is the one place that is the great recruiting tool. This thing that we're talking about as apolitical is the one place where you can actually sell politics. You used to be able to sell stuff in lots of places because people were all watching the same thing. Now you can't. Now you got to go find those segmented places where there are the most eyeballs. And where do you get the most eyeballs? Sunday at 1 o'clock, Sunday at 4 o'clock. You know, and so you start looking at that. You get 60,000 people, 50,000 people at Yankee Stadium. You can do flags and flyovers and militarism. And then you start adding, you know, you start adding to the, you know, what's actually happening in the world, where you look at the cost of war projects. You look at what's happening, what's actually happening. We've got a military presence in 76 countries. That's 39% of the world right now. And you start looking at this, and what I wanted to do was to say, hey, it's all right. There's a reason why we have civilian oversight of the military, especially when you start combining where is this money going to. The point that I was trying to make in that essay is that there's plenty of money in this country. If there's one thing this country has a lot of, it's money. Where are you putting that money? Especially when we're talking about people in Gabe's generation drowning in student debt. I mean, these things are all connected, and yet we think that they're not connected. So it's like, oh, my God, it's the only thing that we talk about. When you look at, you know, free colleges, one of these things in this campaign that's taking place during re-election right now, right? Free college. Oh, how are you going to pay for that? Oh, Medicare for all. How are you going to pay for that? But yet you've got a $738 billion defense budget, and nobody says, how are you going to pay for that? So sports is really doing, you know, its share to move us toward that normalization, that there's plenty of room for the military and nothing for everything else. When at the exact same time, we're talking about this new generation doing worse than their parents and not actually having the resources to have the life that they think they're getting when they get out of college.
Yeah. And what is interesting to me is that criticism of the military, you know, who you can find that'll do that? Servicemen.
I was going to say, the military itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Former active members will do that. And those are the, like, that's actually, to me, the silence group that has the biggest gripe out of anybody else.
Well, absolutely right. And then on top of that, right, they're also, we've moved into this place in our culture where they're the only ones who can say anything. They're the only people now, because they actually wore the uniform. They're the ones who, if they say anything, it's all right. And you know what? That's not true. You can say whatever you want. That's what this is all about. Why, you know, what makes this place different from everywhere else is the fact that you can say supposedly what you want and not have your family be assassinated by the government. That's what makes this different. And if you start taking that away, we are no different than any other country. And so, absolutely, you know, when I start thinking about this, I'm saying, okay, sometimes I think maybe you should reinstitute the draft. Because then when your little angels aren't going to Duke and they're not going to Stanford and they're not going to Temple or whatever school or University of Texas, and now you're putting them out there in their garden and oil field, all of a sudden people are going to start talking again, because now you're messing with your families, you're messing with their futures. And right now what we have is we've got a setup in this country where you have a small number of people of a socioeconomic base doing the fighting, and everybody else, because they don't have to fight, are essentially being taught to be quiet because they don't have to do the fighting. So be grateful that your ass isn't the one who's in Fallujah right now.
Yeah, man. And then the men and women that we send over, and then when they come back, they are struggling out here.
Struggling big time. And you know what's funny about that, Bo? What really hit me too was, think about the anti-blackness and the racializing of this, right? We look at, when you look at what has been said about these black athletes, whether it was LeBron James, although he doesn't criticize the military, but when he has spoken out, people try to get on him, especially someone like Kaepernick or any of the players who have taken a knee. They've been called anti-American. So you've essentially sort of cornered these black athletes to tell them in some ways that they don't belong here. You heard the president say this, you know, maybe you don't belong here. Absolutely articulated the fact that some of these black athletes, simply by having a position, are anti-American, anti-military, anti-troop, right? However, are you ever looking, have you looked at the demographics of the actual military? It's over 50% black and brown. So you're calling these black people and these brown people un-American when the black people and brown people are the ones who actually make up your ranks. And the only difference in so many ways between the black and brown who are wearing the uniform and the black and brown who are wearing a sports jersey in that uniform is athletic talent. Because socioeconomically, they kind of all come from the same place in a lot of ways. And if you didn't have the jump shot, you might be the one wearing the uniform to try and get ahead. And yet, in sports, we've created this dynamic where these black players are rich and unpatriotic, when actually they have more in common with the people fighting than a lot of people in the stands.
Yeah, I'm wondering when exactly, like, is this really just a post-Vietnam thing, that the idea of an opposition to war being treasonous, or is that maybe the first war that people so publicly oppose?
Yeah, I think it's that. I mean, Vietnam, the Vietnam Watergate changed this whole country. I mean, look at what we saw here in the impeachment and everything else. The power, whether it was the power in the military and making sure that journalism did not expose all the terrible things that were happening in the wars, or whether it was powerful politicians making sure that journalism didn't take down a presidency again. That is the important, you know, that period, 1965 to 1975, is one of the most important periods in American history, because it so informs what we see right now. And especially if you're watching the impeachment, or if all of it, you see it, and those roots go back to that. You asked me earlier as well about one of the, chapters that I was really sort of happy with and proud of. And the, one of them was The Mediocre White Boy. And I was thinking about this. I did a talk last night, and we were talking about the real source of that chapter. And it was what I referred to as the assumption of competence. I mean, you go through this in the business. I've gone through this in the business. And when we talk about black advancement, I mean, it's almost like a no way out situation, where if you're not doing well, you're dragging down the society. And yet, if you're in the culture, and if you are doing well, then you're the affirmative action hire. And so it's fascinating to me how in so many businesses you have the assumption of competence that your white coworkers, white male coworkers usually, assume their competence, but they assume your incompetence. And it's a very difficult thing to sort of get past. And there was a lot of conversation about that last night at the reading. I had just been thinking about that.
Yeah, no, that one... That, because the thing about the mediocre, they tend not to realize that they are mediocre, because everybody That's believes right. they got to where they are through, like, That's hard right. work, elbow mm-hmm. grease, training, prayers, and vitamins. Everybody believes that. That mediocre cat don't have no idea. And I've come to find that the mediocre that surround the mediocre don't know the mediocre are mediocre, because they don't know they're mediocre themselves.
That's right. And when you start to think about it in that way, how many people are actually exceptional at what they do? Very few.
Yeah, by definition,
in any
right?
business, by definition, that's why you call them exceptional. And yet, when you listen to people talk, when the white guys do this, they'll look at each other. Even if they don't get the job, they won't say, "Oh, well, the guy who got it doesn't belong in the industry." But when you get it, they look at you like you are given something. The only reason you are here is because you were given something. You were given everything. And I found that to be something that just drove me to the point where I was like, this needs to be written about. But I think the other part of it, too, was I put out, a thought as your mind starts to race in these sort of organic ways when you're writing, this idea that diversity in a lot of ways is anti-blackness. When you start looking at what's happening to the industry, especially the journalism industry, it's very difficult to sort of have allies in some ways because of the slotting in the business. When you start looking at, look at your TV shows, look at your sports panels, white woman host, black ex-player, white ex front office. And then the reporters, for the most part, are generally white. Even in the NBA, you look at the actual reporters who are getting work on these shows. They're white. And so in some ways, from a competitive standpoint, looking at the demographics, you're not going to necessarily have black host, because if you have a black host, now you've got black black host, black ex-player, then that's too black. And you know that people are going to complain about that in terms of viewership. Oh my God, they're taking over. And the people who get erased the most in this dynamic are black women.
Yes.
And it is fascinating because we know that there are so many slots where you're not going to get women in positions anyway. You're not going to get them really doing play-by-play, although that's changing. So where do you fit in this new world? And you can see the erasure that's taken place. And it's almost like diversity of thought versus diversity of color. The black ex-player, I was on a flight with Ryan Clark, and he and I were talking about this. We were sitting next to each other, and I was like, I can't believe this. You and I are in competition for the same job. We don't do the same thing. And what chance do I have against you? You're ex-player. Very interesting to see where this goes.
All right, we'll be back in a minute with more with Howard Bryant. But first, you've heard us talk about Hims and how they're helping guys look their best. Hey, guys, 66% of men lose their hair by age 35, like me, and that is a big problem. So why sit there and do nothing about it when you can turn to medicine and science? Once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. Best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. It's time to grab the new year by the follicles. Here's to a year of personal growth. Time to write a new chapter, and that's one where you've got hair, and the only solution is for Hims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims is helping guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. Prescription solutions backed by science. You'll have no more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. For Hims connects you to real doctors online, which can save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. Answer a few quick questions, the doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that's shipped directly to your door. Dive into 2020 hair first. Right now, my listeners can get started with their first month free. Go to forhims.com/Bomani. That's forhims.com/Bomani. Prescription requires an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Offer valid only if prescribed. 3-month minimum subscription. Additional restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. Remember, that's forhims.com/Bomani. Now, I want to wrap this with a borderline impossible question, but one you'll understand and probably have an answer to. In 2020, what does Colin Kaepernick mean to the larger landscape?
Well, I think he's still central. And I think he's central because he's exposing all of us. He's exposing so much of what we actually believe and what we think. And I think that was one of the first essay of the book was what Colin Kaepernick taught us. And I think that to me, it still resonates that in addition to not having him on the field, that's one thing. But then when Nike rehabilitated him and made him one of their brand spokespeople, one of their brand ambassadors, the number of people who tried to shut that down told me everything I needed to know about anti-blackness in this country. That you had people out there, law enforcement, and average everyday people and merchants and retailers and me trying to boycott Nike. You're going to boycott one of the biggest corporations in the world? All because they did what? Because they gave one person a job? That told me that Colin Kaepernick needed more support. Because that told me that there is a complete movement to destroy one individual. And that told me, if I was wondering if he still had relevance, he had plenty of relevance. Whether we wanted him to be there or not, he's always going to be there. And when you're watching the Super Bowl, these are all, once again, you're watching these Super Bowl ads that we started this program with. There's a Kaepernick influence to that. He's the conscience, man. And it's there's no getting around that.
We had two ads from politicians in that Super Bowl specifically about black people. I can't say geared toward in a way that I can't recall ever being the case. Like, look, we had a point now. It's something else I think people haven't noticed. Remember how we used to have commercials and PSAs all through the month about Black History Month on all the channels, and McDonald's would put the joint out with like Martin Luther King and a candle, with Egg McMuffin in the front or whatever it was. Those are all gone.
That's right. And once again, that is the point that I was trying to make in this book. Really, that is the reason why the book is titled Full Dissidence. It's because when you look at where we are right now, if you just pay attention, you can feel the change. You can feel the change in the flag. When we talk about it, I think you brought up the word aspirational when we first got started, that the flag was always something aspirational. And whether you live down in Texas or Georgia or Boston or Philly or wherever, what white people told us and what our families told us were that it's not perfect, it's getting better, that there was an ideal to aspire to. And today, that flag is to be obeyed. And if you don't like it, you're the problem. If you don't like it, you can leave. If you don't like it, go back to Africa. But whatever it is, that whole idea of aspiration is disappearing. And I'm worried for Black people, Bo, to be perfectly honest with you, especially not myself, because I know how I feel and I know what I see when I look in the mirror. But I worry about the young ones. I worry about these, especially these young African-American kids who are the elites, who are growing up right now, coming out of Duke and Harvard and Princeton. And then they get punched right in the face because they think they've made it. They think that it's different. And you're being reminded right now that it's not. And that at the end of the day, as my uncle would always say, we're 12% of the population. Don't ever forget that.
And on top of that, let me ask, why we always got to go back to Africa? You ever notice nobody even I mean, you just don't want us here. That's fine. Go to Canada, right? Go to Mexico. Why don't you go try one of these islands that are nearby?
Why don't you go back to Costa Rica?
Yeah. Like, why can't I just go somewhere else? Like, it would be one thing if you just wanted to put me out and then give me some free will. Nope. You telling me where I'm going to go to?
Well, that's the reason why the last essay in the book is called Renters. Because no matter how many schools you build, no matter how many gold medals you win, no matter how many of you or your relatives have fought for this country, they feel like you and your citizenship can be removed. It can be taken away on a whim. Why don't you go back where you came from? And that feeling of ownership never belongs to you. And that's the reason why I say to be Black is to be a dissident, because if you're not a dissident, your gripe is simply a grievance of a place that you own a piece of. But for us, the way that this dynamic has worked out and the way it increasingly feels, the minute you open your mouth, they're trying to revoke everything.
Well, here's what I'll wonder about Kaepernick, where, especially after what happened in Atlanta a few months ago, I'm beyond the Colin playing in the NFL point. I'd been beyond it beforehand, yeah. But now, I mean, yeah. It's something that should be mentioned. But like, especially, I think part of what happens as a guy like that gets older, you know?
Oh,
you
exactly. Look. 33 years old, Mitch. What's gonna do?
Yeah, like we're out, like you think about it, we're outside of the "what if Malcolm X was alive" window. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's mm-hmm. it's the same sort of thing here with his career, is that as the years go by, it's gonna be like, okay, well, he probably wouldn't be playing at 35, 36, 37, whatever. But what is it gonna be with him, I wonder, like 5 years from now? Right?
That's right.
Like 5 years from now, as this fades a little bit more into the background. And, you know, the visibility he had as a football player, which is the reason that we talk about him now. We can't ignore that part. Where does it go then? Like, I'm wondering what that next step of the game is going to be for him as we get down the line.
Well, I'm worried about it. I'm very worried about it for him in some ways, because he has not yet represented himself in terms of being visible and talking. So my fear for Colin in the legacy is going to be people asking the question, what was this all for? What was it all for? What was it all about? Was it worth it? Now, all of that can change when we begin to look at over the next 5 years what Colin's second act is going to be. If he comes out and does something remarkable, and I think that he will, and he comes out and does remarkable things, or he comes out and does something with a second act that that staples him as somebody who was indomitable in his moment in time. Otherwise, you can see the erasure taking place. You can see it through all these commercials. You can see it through the Players Coalition. You can see it through time, because the 49ers are a Super Bowl team now. So you're not going to look at him and go, well, he was the last guy to take him to the Super Bowl, because time has replaced that. So the hope is that he remains relevant simply by doing something with his second act where you can look and say, look, this wasn't all for naught. There was a master plan here. And even if it wasn't a master plan, it evolved into something that you have to respect over time. Otherwise, in this culture, time wipes everything out, and very, very quickly.
You know, the football part of this, something interesting that I think has happened is, you know, as the 49ers march, right? And when you have things happen, like the 49ers play the Packers in the playoffs, for example, it became impossible for you not to mention, by the way, the last time Colin Kaepernick, like Raheem Mostert runs to 220 yards and breaks the postseason rushing record for the 49ers
set by
Colin Kaepernick, right? Like, which was interesting to me because it was the reminder that this dude was a monster. Like, I think that even, even if you're of the belief that the league quote unquote caught up to him, which I don't think is fair or appropriate, but if you think that, you can't deny what happened before they quote unquote caught up to him. And so this is, I think, for some people, Ben, because there, some networks have mentioned him, some have not, right? The ones that have mentioned him, all of a sudden, I think for people, it's like, oh, wait a minute. You're telling me this dude played football and was really good? Because I think really be easy to forget that.
It can be really easy. And it's going to get easier, as you said, as time goes on. It's going to be easier. And that goes back to, once again, this erasure and the framework in which he's placed. And we've been dealing with this for 3 years, the number of people who have really, really decided to die on the hill that he wasn't that good.
Yep.
Well, and he wasn't that good. Like, well, you don't know what you were looking at. And I still always believed that if Colin got back into the league, I could see a second act for him where he had a Randall Cunningham type season with the Vikings, because he's got the cannon. He's, you know, if you look at him, he's enormous. He's 6'4", 220, however big he is. There's no doubt in my mind he could still play football. And there's no doubt in my mind he could probably play football as a drop back. He doesn't have to be a read option guy. He's an incredible physical talent. That may never happen and more than likely won't. But it is important to make sure when you go back and you go, oh, yeah, he could ball. He was actually straight balling.
You know who he could have played for this year? The San Francisco 49ers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think enough has been made of this point, right? The 49ers decided, hey, Colin, we're going to move on from you. And it was a fair point to make because they were turning over the coach, the GM. And if you say the new guy wants to bring in his guy, okay, we get that. But the guy they brought in, which, by the way, wasn't really the guy they brought in immediately. They first brought in Brian Hoyer, right? Then they made the trade and brought in Jimmy Garoppolo, who has demonstrated himself to not be that good. And Kyle Shanahan made the point at the time. He was just like, you know, Colin doesn't really fit what it is that I do. And I was just like, okay, I can't say anything about that now. But after 3 years of seeing what y'all do, I feel like anybody can run that offense.
Anybody can run.
Why? Because you're so cold. Like, it's a compliment to you, Kyle Shanahan.
Well, and also what it is that anybody can do what you do because you're a defensive team. That's the point with the 49ers. And if you go back and watch that Super Bowl, and you know, I watched that game, and I'm sitting there looking at this, and I'm thinking, boy, I don't want to be George Kittle the next couple of months because – you were on the biggest stage, and they never found a way to get you the ball. But on the other side, they were running Kelsey out of the backfield to make sure he got the ball. Yeah. And you look at this and you go, yeah, there's no question that there's, you know, they didn't even trust Jimmy Garoppolo to win that ball game for them. And the coach made sure that he didn't lose it for them, and they still lost.
You just not go convince me that Colin Kaepernick could not do what that dude is out here doing. Right? Like, I don't have to make some big grand point, but just show me what there is that Colin Kaepernick could not have done in that offense, right?
I agree with your point on this too, is that look, sometimes everybody needs new energy, even if you go similar, equal, lesser talent. You just need new energy. You need to clear the air. I get that. Open the window, fumigate the room, bet. I understand that. But from a physical standpoint, you're 100% right. And I think part of the narrative, whether or not people want to articulate it or whether they want to articulate it or not, is the fact that it's important to people that Jimmy Garoppolo be really, really good, because then they don't have to talk about Colin Kaepernick anymore. See, he's replaced and this guy's better and the world's better for it. But as long as you have a guy out there who can't, as long as the Brian Hoyers and Jay Cutlers are coming out of retirement, you know, when that's happening, you have to keep talking about Kaepernick because there's this one Super Bowl quarterback on the sidelines that you keep trying to replace and you can't. That's what also when we talk about the specter of Kaepernick, which is why he looms so large in the culture.
All right, we got two teams in the last 3 years that I could legitimately make the argument that they were Colin Kaepernick away from the Super Bowl. That Jaguars team that went out there with Blake Bortles and the San Francisco 49ers.
That's right. And also, if he's so bad and if he can't play and you're so convinced that all he is a backup, put them out there. It won't last long. You'll be vindicated, supposedly, if you're so convinced he can't play. And that's the other thing, too, when you look at the fans out there talking. I love these guys who are just automatically talent evaluators. Oh, he's a backup. Why did you assume he's only a backup? When, you know, where did that narrative come from that suddenly there's no way in the world that he could start? Ryan Fitzpatrick is still starting in the National Football League.
And also, when did your backup quarterback stop being important?
Well, also that.
Like, he's only one of the 35 best quarterbacks on earth.
Well, that's right. And therefore, because of that, he's not worthy of even getting a tryout. Kind of hilarious when you think about it.
That is my man, Howard Bryant. Check out the book, Full Dissonance. It is in stores as we speak. Go ahead and scoop that up. I don't know how the money work on books. I just hope they buy it and make it and get you a little bread for this.
Come on, man. You're an economist. You know how it works. Dude, it doesn't. Here's your math question for today, kids. 2495 times 0.15. That's your royalty. What's that come down to? $3? $2?
Yeah, somewhere.
That's a lot. That's a lot of books, baby. I look at it this way. I was like, you know, ask yourself a question. If I sell one book, can I get on the subway one way? No.
Also,
can I get a pizza with something other than cheese on it? No. Just one slice? No. That's my goal, Bo. My goal is next time I go into negotiation with a book, I'm gonna be like, I'm gonna need two toppings.
I need a pepperoni and a sauce.
I'm gonna need two toppings. They'd be like, two toppings? That might be 20%. Forget it.
Also, tell the people what the next book gonna be.
The next book is called Man of Steel, Ricky Henderson and the Legend of Oakland, and it is so much fun to be working on right now. All about Oakland, all about Ricky. I talked to Reggie Jackson about this yesterday, and you know you're on to a good interview when you got Reggie on the phone for 40 minutes, and he don't even want to talk about Reggie. He wants to talk about Ricky.
Does Reggie still talk about Reggie all the time?
Reggie was great. The first 7 or 8 minutes was all about Reggie. It was all about Reggie. And he's telling me about his business ventures, and he's like, you know, it was great, though, because he told me something I didn't know. He told me that when he went to the Yankees, Montreal had offered him the most money.
Really?
Montreal had offered him $1 million a year. And so think about where history could have gone. It could have been Tim Raines, Andre Dawson, and Reggie Jackson in that outfield.
Yeah. Wow.
And, you know, I didn't know that. And then the second choice, then the Padres were in the game and the Dodgers were his first choice. So it could have been Reggie on the Dodgers or it could have been Reggie on the Padres. It could have been Winfield and Reggie out there in the outfield and the Padres. And he went to the Yankees because his agent told him point blank that this is where you belong, the stage worthy of your abilities. And he says, once I shook George Steinbrenner's hand, there was no turning back. And that's how I became a Yankee. And it was for half the amount of the highest bidder.
Wow.
Which was the Expos. Kind of fun after writing about Trayvon and Ferguson and everything else. I'm going to do a nice baseball project that's real fun, and I'm looking forward to it.
My favorite arrogant Reggie quote ever. What did you think about while you were out? The magnitude of me. What do you say to that?
That nothing. That's a mic drop right there. That is a mic
magnitude of me. Hey, man. Everybody check out Full Dissonance. Howard Bryant, man. Greatly appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure as always. Thank you, buddy.
All right, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you, of course, to Howard Bryant. Thank you also to our sponsors. Thank you to ZipRecruiter. Thank you to 4Hims. Thank you to 5-Hour Energy. And thank you to My Computer Career. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater, and I'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.